lost from view. She stood on the sidewalk and took stock of the encounter. Brian Delacroix had filled out some since 2001. It became him. The Brian she had met had been too skinny, his neck too slim for his head. His cheekbones and chin had been a little too soft. Now his features were clearly defined. He'd reached the age, 35, she was guessing, where he'd probably begun to resemble his father and had stopped looking like someone's son. He dressed far better and was easily twice as handsome as he'd been in 2001, and he'd been plenty handsome then. So, in regards to personal appearance, all changes to the good. But the energy that had come off him, cloaked in pleasantries though it may have been, struck her as mildly unhinged and anxious. It was the energy of someone trying to sell you a timeshare. She knew from her research that he ran international sales and acquisition for Delacroix Lumber, and it saddened her to think that nearly a decade in sales had turned him into a glad-handing, air-kissing showman. She pictured Sebastian, working away at six right now, probably leaning back in a chair, chewing a pencil as he cut tape. Sebastian, the king of the crisp edit. Actually, everything about Sebastian was crisp. Crisp and clean and squared away. She could no more picture him in sales than she could picture him tilling the land. Sebastian was attractive to her, she realized in that moment, because there was nothing desperate or needy in his DNA. Brian Delacroix, she thought. Such a shame life turned you into just another salesman. Jeremy walked her down the aisle at the Church of the Covenant, and his eyes were wet when he lifted her veil. Jeremy, Maureen, Theo, and Charlotte all came to the reception at the Four Seasons. She only saw them a couple of times, but it was as comfortable with Jeremy and as awkward with Maureen and the children as it had always been. After their first meeting, when Maureen had seemed genuinely pleased Rachel had found them, she grew more distant with each subsequent encounter, as if she'd only been welcoming of Rachel because she'd never expected her to hang around. She wasn't rude by any means, or cold. She was simply not present in any substantive way. She smiled at Rachel and complimented her looks or clothing choice, asked about her job and Sebastian, and never failed to mention how happy Jeremy was to have her back in his life. But her eyes refused to lock onto Rachel's, and her voice carried a tone of strained brightness, like an actress trying so hard to remember her lines she forgot their meaning. Theo and Charlotte, the almost half-siblings she never had, treated Rachel with a mixture of deference and furtive panic. They hurried through all conversations, bobbing their heads at the floor, and never once asked her a question about herself, as if to do so would confer upon her the stature of the factual. Instead, it seemed imperative for them to continue to see her as something out of the mythic mist, inexorably moving toward their front door, but never actually arriving. When Maureen, Theo, and Charlotte said their goodbyes, about an hour into the reception, the relief at standing five steps from the exit door was so total it infused their limbs. Only Jeremy was shocked by the abruptness of their departure. Both Maureen and Charlotte feared they were coming down with summer colds, and the drive back was long. Jeremy took Rachel's hands in his and told her not to forget about the Luminists or Column Jasper Whitstone on her honeymoon. There'd be work to do when she returned. "Of course I'll forget," she said, and he laughed. The rest of the family drifted out to the valet stand to wait for the car. Jeremy adjusted his glasses. He fiddled with his shirt where it bunched up around his belly, always self-conscious around her about his excess weight. He shot her his uncertain smile.
"I know you would have wanted your real father to walk you down the aisle, but..."
She gripped his shoulders. "No, no, I was honored."
But...
He shot his wavering smile at the wall behind her, but then looked at her again. His voice grew deeper, stronger.
"It meant the whole wide world to me to be able to do it."
"Me too," she whispered. She placed her forehead on his shoulder. He placed his palm on the back of her neck. And in that moment... she felt as close to whole as she imagined she ever would. After the honeymoon, she and Jeremy found it difficult to get together. Maureen wasn't feeling well, nothing serious, just age, he supposed. But she needed him around, not gallivanting off to Boston to while away the summer in the reading rooms of the BPL or the Athenaeum. They managed to squeeze in lunch once in New London, and he looked weary, the flesh on his face too gray and tight to the bone. Maureen, he confided, was not well. She'd survived breast cancer 2 years ago. She had endured a double mastectomy, but her latest scans had come back inconclusive. Meaning? She reached across the table and covered his hand with her own.
Meaning, he said. Her cancer could have recurred. They're going to run more tests next week.
He adjusted and readjusted his glasses, then looked over them at her with a smile that said he was changing the subject.
How are the newlyweds?
Buying a house, she said brightly.
In the city?
She shook her head, still coming to terms with it. About 30 miles south, give or take. It needs updates and renovations, so we won't move in right away. But it's a good town, good school system, if we have kids. It's not far from where Sebastian grew up. It's also where he keeps his boat.
He loves that boat.
Hey, he loves me too.
I didn't say he didn't.
Jeremy shot her a wry smile.
I just said he loves that boat.
4 days later, Jeremy suffered a stroke in his office at the college. He suspected it was a stroke, but he wasn't 100% sure, so he drove himself to the nearest hospital. He drove his car halfway up onto a curb and staggered to the entrance. He made it to the ER on his own 2 feet, but promptly suffered a second stroke in the waiting room. The first orderly to reach him was surprised by the strength in Jeremy's soft professor's hands when he grabbed the lapels of the orderly's lab coat. The last words Jeremy would speak for some time made little sense to the orderly, or to anyone else for that matter. He yanked the orderly's face down to his own, and his eyes bulged in their sockets.
Rachel, he slurred, is in the mirror.
Chapter 6 Detachments. Maureen shared the orderly's claim with Rachel during Jeremy's third night in the hospital.
Rachel is in the mirror? Rachel repeated.
That's what Amir said. Maureen nodded. You look tired. You should get your rest.
Rachel had to be back at work in an hour. She'd be late. Again.
I'm fine.
In the bed, Jeremy stared up at the ceiling, his mouth agape, his eyes wiped clean of awareness.
The drive must be terrible, Charlotte said.
It's not bad.
Rachel sat on the windowsill because there were only 3 chairs in the room, and they were all occupied by family.
The doctors said he could be like this for months, Theo said. Or longer.
Both Charlotte and Maureen began weeping. Theo went to them. The 3 of them huddled in their grief. For a few minutes, all Rachel could see of them was their heaving backs. A week later, Jeremy was moved to a neurotreatment facility and gradually recovered some motor ability and the most rudimentary kernels of speech. Yes, no, bathroom. He looked at his wife as if she were his mother, at his son and daughter as if they were his grandparents, at Rachel as if he were trying to place her. They tried reading to him, scrolled through his favorite paintings on an iPad, played his beloved Schubert, and none of it connected. He wanted food, he wanted comfort, he wanted relief from the pains in his head and body. He engaged the world with the terrified narcissism of an infant. The family made it clear to Rachel that she could visit as much as she wanted. They were far too polite to say otherwise, but they failed to include her in most conversations and were always visibly relieved when she had to go. At home, Sebastian grew resentful. She'd barely known the man, he'd argue. She was sentimentalizing an attachment that didn't really exist.
You need to let it go, he said.
No, she replied. You do.
He held up an apologetic hand and closed his eyes for a moment to let her know he had no interest in a big fight. He opened his eyes, and his voice was softer and conciliatory.
You know they're considering you for Big Six.
Big Six was what they called the national network in New York.
I didn't know that. She tried to keep the excitement from her voice.
You're being groomed. Now isn't the time to ease up on the throttle.
I'm not.
Because they'll test you on something big, something national scale.
Such as?
A hurricane, a mass murder, I don't know, a celebrity death.
How will we soldier on, she wondered aloud, after Whoopi has passed?
It'll be hard, he agreed, but she would have wanted us to show courage.
She chuckled, and he nestled into her on the couch. Sebastian kissed the side of her neck.
This is us, babe, me and you, joined at the hip. Where I go. Where you go, I go.
I know, I do.
I think it'd be cool to live in Manhattan.
Which neighborhood? She asked.
Upper West Side, he said.
Harlem, she said at the same time. They both laughed it off because it felt like what one did when crucial differences in a marriage revealed themselves in strictly theoretical terms. Jeremy James improved significantly through the fall. He remembered who Rachel was, though not what he'd said to the orderly, and he seemed to tolerate her presence more than rely on it. He had retained most of his knowledge of the Luminist movement and of column Jasper Whitstone, but it was disjointed, his general sense of chronology off, so that Whitstone's vanishing in 1863 was placed on a timeline just prior to Jeremy's first trip to Normandy in 1977, when he was a graduate fellow. He thought Rachel was younger than Charlotte and couldn't understand some days why Theo could take so much time off from high school to visit him.
He doesn't apply himself in the first place, he told Rachel. I don't want him using my sickness to apply himself even less.
He moved back into the house on Gorham Lane in November and was attended to by a hospice nurse. He grew physically stronger. His speech grew clear, but his mind remained elusive to him.
I can't quite grasp it, he said once.
Both Maureen and Rachel were in the room, and he gave them his hesitant smile.
It's like I'm in a beautiful library, but none of the books have titles.
In late December of 2009, Rachel twice caught him checking his watch in the first 10 minutes of her visit. She couldn't blame him. Without their shared detective stories to discuss, he to find evidence of column Jasper Whitstone crossing paths with Claude Monet, she to find her father, and the both of them to understand Elizabeth Childs, they had little to talk about. No shared ambition, no shared history. She promised to stay in touch. Leaving his house, she walked down the flagstone path to her car, and she felt the loss of him anew. Felt, too, the old suspicion that life, as she had thus far experienced it, was a series of detachments. Characters crossed the stage, and some hung around longer than others, but all ultimately exited. She looked back at his house as she reached her car. You were my friend, she thought. You were my friend. 2 weeks later, on January 12th, a magnitude 7.0 earthquake hit Haiti at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. As Sebastian had predicted, Rachel was assigned to cover it for Big Six. She spent her first few days in Port-au-Prince. She and her crew covered the airdrops of food and supplies, which most days ended in riots. They covered the corpses stacked up in the parking lot of General Hospital. They covered the makeshift crematoriums that sprang up on street corners all over the city, the bodies burning like sacrificial appeasements, gray sulfur roiling amid the oily black smoke, the body within already an abstraction, the smoke as unremarkable as all the other smoke, from the buildings that continued to smolder, from the gas lines that had yet to burn out. She reported from tent cities and medical relief posts. Down in what had once been the shopping district, she and her camera operator, Greta Kilborn, shot footage of the police firing on looters, of a young man with protruding teeth and ribs, lying in ash and rubble with his foot blown off at the ankle, a few cans of the food he'd been stealing lying just out of his reach. In the days after the earthquake, the only thing that teemed in Port-au-Prince more than disease and hunger was the press corps.
Soon she and Greta decided to follow the story to the epicenter of the quake, in the coastal town of Laogan. Laogan was only 40 kilometers south of Port-au-Prince, but the journey took them 2 days. They could smell the dead 3 hours before they arrived. There was no infrastructure left, no aid, no government relief, no police to shoot looters because there were no police. When Rachel compared it to hell, Greta disagreed. In hell, she said, someone's in charge. Their second night at a squatter's camp cobbled together from sheets, sheets for roofs and sheets for walls. She, Greta, one ex-nun, and one almost nurse moved 4 young girls from tent to tent. The 6 wannabe rapists who moved through the camp looking for the girls were armed with knives and serpettes, the machetes with hooked blades common among farmers. Before the earthquake, half these men, Rachel was assured, had held good jobs. Their leader, Josué Dasleu, had come from the countryside just east of the quake zone. 9th in line for a small sorghum farm in Croix des Bouquets, he soured on the world when it sank in that he would never inherit the farm. Josué Dasleu looked like a movie star and moved like a rock star. He usually wore a green and white soccer polo over tan cargo pants with the cuffs rolled up. On his left hip, he wore a Desert Eagle 45 automatic, and on his right, he wore a serpette in a battered leather scabbard. He assured everyone that the serpette was for his protection. The 45, he said with a wink, was for theirs. Lot of bad men around, lot of horror, lot of evildoers. He'd bless himself and raise his eyes to the heavens. 80% of Laogan had been cratered by the quake, leveled. Law and order was a memory. There were rumors that British and Icelandic search and rescue teams had been sighted in the area. Rachel had confirmed earlier in the day that the Canadians had docked a destroyer in the harbor, and Japanese and Argentinian doctors were trickling into what remained of downtown. But so far, no one had reached them. That morning and afternoon had been spent helping Ronald Revelus, the man who'd been on his way to becoming a nurse before the quake. They'd transported the 3 mortally wounded members of the camp to a med tent run by Sri Lankan peacekeepers 3 miles east. It was there she'd spoken to a translator who'd assured her they'd get help to them as soon as they were capable, hopefully by the following night, 2 days at the most. Rachel and Greta returned to the camp, and the 4 girls had arrived. The itchy, hungry men in Josué's gang noticed them immediately, and their awful intentions spread from the mind of one to the mind of all in the time it took to get the girls water and check them for injury. Rachel and Greta, who failed as reporters that night by getting involved in a story they should have covered if anyone would have put it on the air, worked with the ex-nun and Ronald Revelus to move the girls all over the camp, rarely staying in one hiding spot for more than an hour. The light of day wouldn't stop the men. Rape was nothing to be ashamed of in their minds, or the minds of most of their peers. Death, so the norm in recent days, was only to be lamented for natives, and even then, only if they were close family. They'd continued drinking through the night's search and into the dawn, and the hope was they'd have to sleep at some point. In the end, 2 of the 4 girls were saved when a UN truck trundled into the camp that morning, accompanied by a bulldozer to pick up the corpses in the ruined church at the bottom of the hill. The other 2 girls, however, were never seen again. They'd arrived in camp just hours before, both freshly orphaned and freshly homeless. Esther wore a faded red t-shirt and jean shorts. The one in the pale yellow dress was Widlen, but everyone called her Widdy. It made sense that Esther was sullen, nearly mute, and rarely met one's eyes. What made no sense was that Widdy was sunny and had the kind of smile that blew canyons through the chests of its recipients. Rachel knew the girls only for that one night, but she'd spent most of it with Widdy. Widdy and her yellow dress and her boundless heart and her habit of humming songs no one could recognize. It was remarkable how completely they disappeared. Not just their bodies and the clothes they'd been wearing, but their very existence. An hour after sunup, their two companions went mute when asked about them. Within 3 hours, no one in the camp besides Rachel, Greta, the ex-nun Veronique, and Ronald Revelis claimed to have seen them. By nightfall of the second day, Veronique had changed her story, and Ronald was questioning his memory. At 9 that night, Rachel accidentally caught the eye of one of the rapists, Paul, a high school science teacher who was always unceasingly polite. Paul sat outside his tent and clipped his nails with rusty nail clippers. By that point, rumors had spread that if the girls ever had been in the camp, and they hadn't, that was crazy talk, 3 of the 6 men who had roamed the camp drinking heavily that night had gone to sleep by the time the girls who never existed may or may not have disappeared. So if those girls had been raped, and they hadn't been, they couldn't have been, they didn't exist, Paul was involved. But if they'd been murdered, and they hadn't been, they couldn't have been, they didn't exist, Paul had been sleeping by that point. Just a rapist, Teacher Paul, just a rapist. If the fates of the girls haunted him in any way, however, he hid it well. He looked in Rachel's eyes. He used his thumb and index finger to make a gun. He pointed it at her crotch and then slipped the finger into his mouth and sucked on it. He laughed without making a sound. Then he rose to his feet and crossed to Rachel. He stood in front of her and searched her eyes. Very politely, almost obsequiously, he asked her to leave the camp.
"You lie," he explained gently, "and it makes people anxious. They do not tell you this because we are a polite people, but your lies make everyone very upset. Tonight," he held up one finger, "no one will show how upset they are. Tonight,"
again with the finger,
"no harm will likely come to you and your friend."
She and Greta left the camp 20 minutes later, hitching the only ride out with the Sri Lankans. At their relief center, she pleaded with them and the Canadian peacekeepers who'd worked their way inland from their ship. No one got her sense of urgency. No one got within a zip code of it. A couple of girls disappeared? Here? There were thousands of disappeared at last count, and the number would only grow. "They're not disappeared," one of the Canadians said to her. "They're dead. You know that. I'm sorry, but so it is. And no one's got the time or resources to search for the bodies." He looked around the tent at his companions and a few of the Sri Lankans. Everyone nodded in agreement. "None of us, anyway." The next day, Rachel and Greta moved on to Jacmel. 3 weeks later, they were back in Port-au-Prince. By this point, Rachel was starting her day with 4 black market Ativans and a shot of rum. Greta, she suspected, had relapsed into the predilection for heroin chipping she'd told Rachel about their first night in Leogan. Eventually, they received word that it was time to head home. When Rachel protested, her assignment editor confided via Skype that her stories had grown too strident, too monotonous, and had taken on an unfortunate air of despair. "Our viewers need hope," the assignment editor said. "Haitians need water," Rachel said. "There she goes again," the editor said to someone off screen. "Give us a few more weeks." "Rachel," he said. "Rachel, you look like shit. And I'm not just talking about your hair. You're skeletal. We're pulling the plug." "No one cares," Rachel said. "We cared," the assignment editor said sharply. "The United States is sending over $1.5 billion fucking dollars to that island, and this network covered the shit out of it. What more do you want?" And Rachel, in her Ativan-addled brain, thought, "God. I want the capital G God the televangelists claim moves tornadoes out of their paths. The one who cures cancer and arthritis in the faithful. The God professional athletes thank for taking an interest in the outcome of the Super Bowl or the World Cup. Or a home run hit in the 87th game of the 162 played by the Red Sox this year." She wanted the active God who inserted himself in human affairs to reach down from heaven and cleanse the Haitian water supply and cure the Haitian sick and uncrumble the crumbled schools and hospitals and homes. "The fuck are you babbling about?"
The assignment editor peered into the screen at her. She hadn't realized she'd spoken.
"Get on a plane while we're still paying for it," the assignment editor said, "and get back to your little station."
And that's how she learned any ambitions she'd had to make the national network scene were dead. No New York for her, no career track to Big Six and beyond. Back to Boston, back to Little Six, back to Sebastian. She weaned herself off Ativan. It took 4 attempts, but she got there. She cut her drinking back to pre-Haiti levels, or in the neighborhood anyway. But the bosses at Little Six never gave her a lead story again. A new girl, Jenny Gonzalez, had arrived during the time she'd been gone. Sebastian said, "She's smart, accessible, and she doesn't look at the camera sometimes like she might headbutt it." The ugly truth was that Sebastian was right. Rachel would have loved to hate Jenny Gonzalez, Lord knows she tried, to believe her looks and sex appeal had gotten her where she was. And while those things certainly didn't hurt, Jenny had an M.A. in journalism from Columbia, could improv on the fly, always hit her marks fully prepared, and treated everyone from the receptionist to the GM with the same respect. Jenny Gonzalez didn't replace Rachel because she was younger, prettier, and more well-endowed, though she was all of those things, goddammit. She replaced Rachel because she was better at her job, had a more easygoing nature, and people loved talking to her. There had still been a chance for Rachel, though. If, through clean living, she reversed the aging process she'd accelerated in Haiti, if she removed the chip on her shoulder that had first appeared and then kept growing there, if she kissed ass and played ball and transformed herself back into that slightly sexy, slightly tomboyish, slightly nerdy, they gave her red horn-rimmed glasses in place of her contacts, wholly knowledgeable ace reporter they'd hired away from the Globe for big bucks in the first place, then she still had a home at Little Six. She tried. She covered a cat that barked like a dog and the annual breaking of the ice by the L Street Brownies, a group of mostly naked men who were the first to brave the waters of Boston Harbor every year. She reported on the baby koala born at Franklin Park Zoo and the running of the brides at Filene's basement. She and Sebastian rehabbed the house they'd bought south of the city. Their schedules were such that when he was at the house, she was at work and vice versa. To rarely see each other was such a pleasant arrangement that she would, in hindsight, come to believe it added a year to their marriage. She received a couple of emails from Brian Delacroix. And even though one of them, "You did magnificent work in Haiti. People in this city care now because you cared," carried her through an otherwise shitty day, she reminded herself that Brian Delacroix was a salesman, one with a weird energy that probably stemmed from his soul being at odds with the career decisions he'd made. She couldn't trust there was a real Brian left anymore, so her responses to his emails were limited and polite. "Thanks. Glad you enjoyed it. Take care." She told herself she was happy. She told herself she was trying to get back to the reporter and wife and person she'd been before. But she couldn't sleep, and she couldn't stop watching the feeds from Haiti, following the country as it scrabbled for rebirth, but mostly just continued to die. Cholera broke out along the Artibonite River. This was followed by rumors that UN soldiers were the source of it. She begged Clay Bonn, her assignment editor, to let her go back for a week, even at her own expense. He didn't even dignify the request with a response, just told her she was expected in the parking lot behind the station, where she'd hop a van to cover a 6-year-old in Lawrence who claimed God had given him the numbers his mother used to win the lottery. When cameras secretly filmed UN soldiers removing a leaking pipe from the ground along the banks of the Artibonite, and the footage went viral, Rachel was interviewing a 100-year-old Red Sox fan attending his first game at Fenway. As the cholera continued to spread, Rachel covered back-to-back house fires, a hot dog eating contest, a weekend of gang-related shootings in Dorchester, 2 elderly sisters who created end tables out of bottle caps, a BC party that got out of control in Cleveland Circle,
and a former Wall Street broker who turned his back on high finance to do outreach work with the homeless on the North Shore. The stories weren't all tripe. They weren't all inconsequential. Rachel had almost convinced herself that she occasionally performed a valid public service when Hurricane Thomas hit Haiti. Only a few people died, but the shelters were wiped out, sewers and septic tanks overflowed, and the cholera outbreak metastasized across the island. She'd been up all night, following the available footage and reading the reports as they came across the wires, when Brian Delacroix's name popped up in her inbox. She opened his email, and all it said was, "Why aren't you in Haiti? We need you there." It was as if someone had placed a warm hand to the side of her neck and tilted her face to his shoulder and let her close her eyes. Maybe, since that off-kilter encounter outside the Athenaeum, she'd been judging Brian too harshly. Maybe she'd just caught him on a bad day, as he was trying to close a deal with Jack Ahern, an antiquities dealer from Geneva. Rachel had no idea where lumber and antiquities could cross paths, but she didn't really understand finance. Maybe Jack Ahern was an investor of some kind. In either case, so Brian had acted a little odd, a little nervous. What was wrong with being a little odd and a little nervous? "Why aren't you in Haiti? We need you there." He understood. Somehow, from a remove of years and through the scantest of cyber contact, he grasped that it was crucial she get back there. And as if she'd ordered it up like a pizza, half an hour later Sebastian came home and said, "They're sending you back." "Back where?" He pulled a plastic bottle of water from the fridge and placed it to the side of his head. He closed his eyes.
"You have the contacts. You know the customs, I guess."
"Haiti. They're sending me back to Haiti?" He opened his eyes as he continued to massage his temple with the bottle.
"Haiti. Yeah."
Though he'd never spoken the words, Rachel knew he blamed Haiti for her career decline, and he blamed her career decline for his own career stagnation. So when he said Haiti, it sounded like an obscenity. "When?" Her blood was tingling. She'd been up all night, but now she was wide awake.
"Clay said no later than tomorrow. Do I have to remind you that you can't fuck this up?"
She felt her face drop. "That's your pep talk?"
"It is what it is,"
he said wearily. She could think of a lot of things to say, but they all would have led to a fight, and she didn't want to fight right now. So she tried, "I'll miss you." She couldn't wait to get on the plane.
"Miss you too,"
he said, as he stared into the refrigerator. Chapter 7. Have You Seen Me? Back in Haiti, the same heat and crumpled buildings and exhausted despair, the same bewildered looks on most of the faces. Where there was no bewilderment, there was rage. Where there wasn't rage, there was hunger and fear, but mostly bewilderment. After all this suffering, the faces seemed to ask, are we to accept that suffering is the point? On her way to do her first story, meeting the crew out in front of Chauscal Hospital, in the dense slum of Cité Soleil, Rachel walked streets so poor a newcomer would have been unable to discern the difference in the neighborhood before the quake and after it. Photos were pasted to broken lamp poles and impotent power line poles and the low walls that lined the streets. Pictures, in some cases, of the dead, but primarily of the missing. Under most of the photos, a question or plea was written.
Esque ou te wem?
Have you seen me? She hadn't. Or maybe she had. Maybe the face of the middle-aged man she passed as she turned a corner was one of the bodies she'd seen in the collapsed church or the hospital parking lot. In either case, he was gone. And not coming back, she was fairly sure. Rachel crested a small hill, and the breadth of the ghetto spread out before her, a spillage of steel and cinder-block shacks sun-blasted to monochrome. A boy rode past her on a muddy bicycle. The boy looked to be about 11, 12 at most, and had an automatic rifle strapped to his back. As he looked over his shoulder at her, Rachel reminded herself that this was gang territory. Many war gods ran the show and fought for turf from one end to the other. Food didn't flow into here, but guns sure as shit did. She shouldn't have been walking around there alone. She shouldn't have been walking around there without a tank and air support. But she didn't feel fear. She just felt numb. She felt overwhelmed with numbness. At least she thought that's what it was. Have you seen me? No, I haven't. No one has. No one did. No one will. Even if you've lived a full life, didn't matter. You vanished the moment you were born. That was the mood she carried into the little plaza in front of the hospital. The sole good news about what happened was that it only went live to the local market, in this case, Boston. Big Six was going to decide later if they'd use it. Little Six, though, believed a live feed would stoke a sense of urgency in a story everyone suspected was losing viewer interest because of tragedy fatigue. So she went live, standing in front of Choskal Hospital. The sun slipped out from a black brick of clouds directly above her head and set itself to sear. Grant, the anchor at Little Six, somehow managed to sound twice as stupid coming through an international feed. Rachel rattled off the statistics. 32 confirmed cholera cases lay bedridden in the hospital behind her. Post-hurricane flooding was contributing to the spread on a national scale and complicating relief efforts. The situation was expected to grow more dire by the day. Behind the camera crew, Cité Soleil spread out like a sacrifice to the sun god, and Rachel could feel something sever within her. It was a spiritual peace, and untouched by this world up until this moment, a sliver of soul, perhaps, and the heat and loss hunted it down as soon as it detached and ate it. In its place, a sparrow flapped its wings in the center of her chest. No warning, no build-up. It suddenly hovered in the center of her chest, flapping as hard as it could.
"And excuse me, Rachel," Grant was saying in her ear. "But Rachel—"
Why did he keep saying her name? "Yes, Grant?"
"Rachel?"
She consciously avoided gritting her teeth.
"Yes?" "Do you have any estimates on how many people have contracted this deadly disease? How many people are sick?"
The question struck her as absurd. "How many people are sick? We're all sick."
"I'm sorry?"
Grant said.
"We're all sick," Rachel said.
Was it her imagination, or did the words come out a tad slurry?
"Rachel, are you saying that you and other members of our Channel 6 crew have contracted cholera?"
"What? No."
Danny Marotta removed his eye from the lens and gave her a "you-okay" look. Witty walked behind him with a graceful stride that didn't fit with her youth or the blood on her dress or the second smile carved into her throat.
"Rachel," Grant was saying. "Rachel? I'm afraid I don't understand."
And Rachel, sweating profusely by this point, shaking so hard the mic jumped in her hand, replied, "I said we're all sick. We're just sick, you know?" The words sluiced out of her like blood from a puncture wound. "We're lost and sick and we all pretend otherwise, but then we all go away. We all just fucking go away." By the time the sun went down, footage of Rachel repeating, "We're all sick," to a baffled anchorman as her hands and shoulders shook and her eyelids batted at the sweat that drizzled from her forehead, had gone viral. It was the consensus of upper management during a post-mortem meeting that while it was commendable that the feed was cut 4 seconds before Rachel said fucking, it should have been cut 10 seconds earlier. As soon as it became clear that Rachel was unhinged, and most agreed that moment occurred the very first time she said, "We're all sick," they should have cut to commercial. Rachel was fired over cell phone as she walked across the tarmac at Toussaint-Louverture Airport toward the plane home. Her first night back, she went to a bar in Marshfield, a few blocks away from their house. Sebastian was working through the night and had made it clear he had no desire to see her right now. He said he'd stay on his boat until he could process what she'd done to them. She couldn't blame him, really. It would be a few weeks before the reality of what had become of her career would sink in, but when she caught her reflection in the bar mirror as she drained her vodka,
She was startled by how frightened she looked. She didn't feel frightened. She felt numb. Yet she stared over the scotch and whiskey bottles to the right of the cash register at a woman who looked a bit like her mother, a bit like herself, and every bit terrified. The bartender clearly hadn't seen the video of her meltdown. He treated her the way bored bartenders the world over treated customers they couldn't give a shit about. It was a slow night, so he wasn't making his nut in tips, no matter how hard he shucked and smiled. So he did neither. He read a newspaper at the other end of the bar and texted with someone on his phone. She checked her own texts, but she didn't have any. Everyone she knew was ducking and hiding until the gods decided how fiercely they wanted to continue their assault, or whether they could relent and spit her back out. She did have one email, though, and even before she tapped the mail icon, she knew who it was from, and smiled when she saw Brian Delacroix's name. Rachel, you didn't deserve to be punished for being human while surrounded by inhumanity. You didn't deserve to be fired or condemned. You deserved a fucking medal. Just one man's opinion. Hang in there. B.D. Who are you? She thought. You strange man with mostly perfect timing. One of these days, Brian Delacroix, I would like to...
What?
I would like to give you a chance to explain that weird encounter outside the Athenaeum, because I can't connect that guy with the guy who just sent me this note. The bartender brought her another vodka, and she decided she'd head back to her apartment, maybe compose an email to Brian Delacroix that articulated some of the thoughts that had just passed through her head. She handed the bartender her credit card and told him he could cash her out. As he rang up the sale, she felt beset by déjà vu stronger than any she could remember. No, it wasn't simply déjà vu. She'd experienced this precise moment before. She was sure of it. She caught the bartender's eyes in the mirror, and he gave her a curious look in return, as if unsure why she stared so intently at him. "I don't know you," she thought, "but I know this moment. I've lived it." And then she realized she hadn't. Her mother had. It was a restaging of the photograph of her mother in roughly the same place at a similarly shaped bar in similar lighting 31 years before. Like her mother, she stared absently at the bottles. Like the bartender in the picture, the bartender tonight had his back to her as he rang up the sale. His eyes hung in the mirror. Her eyes hung in the mirror. "Look for yourself in his eyes," her mother had said. "Rachel is in the mirror," Jeremy had said. The bartender brought her the check. She added a tip and signed it. She left her drink unfinished on the bar and hurried back to the house. She went to her bedroom and opened the shoebox full of photos. The photographs from the bar in East Baltimore were on the top of the pile where she and Jeremy had left them 2 summers ago. Rachel followed her mother's gaze over the whiskey bottles to the mirror behind them, to what Elizabeth had really been looking at, to what had put the charged look, the eroticized look, on her face. The bartender's face loomed above the cash register, his eyes locked on Elizabeth's. The green in his eyes was so pale it was almost gray. Rachel took the photograph to her bathroom mirror. She held it up beside her head. His eyes were her eyes, same color, same shape. "Well, shit," she said. "Hi, Dad." Chapter 8. Granite. She'd assumed the bar was long gone, but when she Googled Milo's East Baltimore, it popped right up on her screen, replete with pictures. It had changed some. 3 large windows had been hung in the brick wall facing the street. The lighting was softer, the cash register was computerized, and the stools now had backs and ornate arms, but the same mirror hung behind the bar, and the bottles were placed in the same hierarchy. The Baltimore Colts pennant on the wall had been replaced with one for the Baltimore Ravens. She called and asked for the owner. When he got on the phone, he said, "This is Ronnie." She explained that she was a reporter for Channel 6. She didn't say which Channel 6, and she didn't say she was working on any particular story.
Usually identifying herself as a reporter immediately opened a door or immediately slammed it shut. Either scenario tended to avoid time wasted on further explanations. Ronnie, I'm trying to track down a bartender who worked at Milo's in 1979, and I wondered if you'd have any employment records from that era you'd be willing to share.
Bartender back in 79?
He said.
Well, that was probably Lee, but let me check with my father.
Lee? She said, but he put the phone down. For a few minutes, she heard very little, maybe a conversation being held somewhere far away from the receiver, hard to tell, but then she heard footsteps approach the phone and the scrape of it being lifted off the bar.
This is Milo.
A scratchy voice, followed by the huff of breath being expelled through the nostrils. The Milo?
Yeah, yeah. What's this you need?
I was looking to get in touch with a man who tended bar there almost 32 years ago. Your son mentioned a Lee?
He worked for us back then.
And you remember him?
Well, yeah. He worked here at least 25 years. Left about 8 years ago.
And he was the only bartender who worked there back then?
No, but he was the main one. I worked the bar some. My late wife and old Harold, who was going senile right about then. That clear it up for you?
Do you know where I could find Lee?
Why don't you tell me why you're asking, Miss...
Childs.
Miss Childs, why don't you tell me why you're asking about Lee?
She couldn't think of a single reason to lie, so she told him. It's possible he knew my mother.
Lee knew a lot of women.
She took the plunge. It's possible he was my father. There was nothing but the sound of him breathing through his nostrils for so long she almost spoke again out of sheer anxiousness.
How old are you?
He said eventually. 31.
Well,
Milo said slowly.
He was a good-looking son of a bitch back then. Dated a few 10 women, I seem to remember. Even a penny can shine, I guess, when it's newly minted.
More breathing. She thought he was going to say more, but after a while realized he wouldn't be doing so. I'd like to reach out to him. If you'd feel okay helping me, that would...
He's dead.
Two small hands grasped the sides of her heart and pushed inward. Ice water surged up the back of her neck and flooded her skull. He's dead? It came out louder than she'd intended.
About 6 years now, yeah. He left us, went to work for another bar in Elkton. A couple years after that, he died.
How?
Heart attack.
He would have been young.
53?
Milo said.
Maybe 54. Yeah, he was young.
What was his full name?
Well, miss, I don't know you. I don't know if you could lodge some paternity thing against the people he left behind. I don't know enough about such things. But again, I don't know you, that's the problem.
Would it help if you did know me?
Absolutely.
She took the train to Baltimore the next morning from Back Bay Station. She innocently met the eyes of a college-age girl she passed on the platform, and the girl's eyes bulged with sudden recognition. Rachel walked to the end of the platform with her head down. She took a spot near an older gentleman in a gray suit. He flashed her a sad smile and went back to reading Bloomberg Markets. She couldn't tell if the sadness in his smile stemmed from pity for her or if he just possessed a sad smile. She got on the train without further incident and found a seat near the rear of a half-empty car. With every mile the train covered, she felt she escaped her newfound identity as a public basket case just a bit more. By the time she passed through Rhode Island, she felt nearly relaxed. She wondered if some of her ease stemmed from the knowledge that she was returning, if not home, at least to her genesis. She also took strange comfort that she was following, in reverse part, the journey her mother and Jeremy James had taken to Western Massachusetts in the spring of 1979. Now it was mid-November, more than 3 decades later. The cities and towns she passed were caught between late fall and early winter. Some municipal parking lots had already shored up road salt and sand. Most trees were bare, and the sky was sunless, as bare as the trees.
This is him here.
Milo placed a framed photograph on the bar in front of her, his stubby index finger positioned beside the face of a lean man of advancing hairline and advancing age. He had a high forehead, sunken cheeks, and her eyes. Milo was about 80 and breathed with the aid of a liquid oxygen canister perched in a hip pack nestled at the small of his back. The clear silicone tubing ran up his back and then hooked over his ears before draping down his cheekbones to where the nasal cannulas entered his nostrils. He'd been living with emphysema since his early 70s, he told Rachel. Later, the hypoxia had been progressing, but not so fast it kept him from sneaking 8 or 10 cigarettes a day.
Good genes,
Milo said as he placed an unframed photo down in front of her.
I got him. Lee didn't.
The unframed shot was a bit more candid than the first, which was a staff photo in which everyone was posing. This unframed photograph was from decades back. Lee had a full head of lanky, dark brown hair, and his eyes were set farther up in his face. He was smiling at something a customer had said. While several of the other patrons laughed with their heads thrown back, Lee's was a small smile, a withholding one. It wasn't an invitation, it was a mote. He looked to be no more than 27 or 28, and she could immediately see what her mother had been drawn to. That small smile was all coiled vitality and inflamed reticence. It promised too much and too little at the same time. Lee looked like the worst boyfriend and greatest fuck of all time. She could see why her mother had described him as smelling like lightning, and she suspected that if she herself had walked into this bar in 1979 and this man had been standing behind it, she would have stayed for more than one drink. He fit the look of the profligate poet, the drug-addled painter genius, the musician who'd die in a car crash the day after he signed his big record contract. The tour of Lee's life she received from Milo in photos, however, was of a journey confined mostly to the very bar where she now sat. She could feel his world and his options and his opportunities for casual sex with vibrant women decrease with every photo. Soon, the world beyond the bar wasn't something to dream of, it was something to hide from. The women who once pursued him turned into women who had to be pursued. They then became women who had to be lubricated with the proper amounts of humor and alcohol. Finally, one day, they'd be repulsed or amused to discover he thought of them sexually. But as Lee's sexual voltage decreased year by year, his smiles grew wider. By the time he'd reached her middle school years and still wore the black vest over a white shirt that Milo required of his bartenders, his skin had mottled, his face had sunk, and his smile had yellowed and picked up 2 gaps in the back rows. But with every photo, he looked looser, less burdened by the weight of whatever had been behind that fuck-you smile, that fuck-you sexual charisma. The soul seemed to flower as the body declined. Milo next produced a stack of photographs from the annual Independence Day Friends and Family softball game and picnic. There were 2 women who appeared and reappeared in the photos alongside Lee. One woman was thin and brunette and possessed a face tight with strain and anxiety. The other was blowsy and blonde and usually had a drink in one hand and a cigarette in the other.
That was Ellen,
Milo said of the dark-haired woman.
She was angry. No one ever knew why. Kinda woman could suck the life out of a birthday party, a wedding, a Thanksgiving, and I seen her kill all 3. She left Lee around 86, I want to say, 87. No, later. Other one was a second wife. That's Maddie. Last I heard, she was still alive, living in Elkton. She and Lee had a good few years and then sort of drifted apart.
Did he have any kids? Rachel asked.
Not with these women.
Milo watched her carefully, across the bar for a moment, as he reached behind his back to adjust something on his oxygen dispenser.
You think you're his, huh?
I'm pretty sure of it, Rachel said.
You got his eyes,
Milo said.
That's for sure. Pretend I said something funny.
What?
Laugh,
he said. Ha ha, she said,
No, for real.
She looked around the bar. It was empty. She chuckled out a version of her laugh. She was surprised how authentic it sounded.
That's his laugh,
Milo said. Then it's settled, she said. He smiled.
When I was young, people said I looked like Warren Oates. You know who that is?
She shook her head.
Movie actor. Was in a lot of westerns. Was in the Wild Bunch.
She gave him an embarrassed shrug.
Anyway, I did look like Warren Oates. Now people say I look like Wilfred Brimley. Know who that is?
She nodded. The Quaker Oats guy. He said,
That's him.
You do look like him.
I do.
He held up a finger.
And yet, best of my knowledge, I'm not related to him. Or to Warren Oates.
He held his thumb and index a hair breadth apart.
Not even a little bit.
She acknowledged his point with a slight tip of her head. Arrayed across the bar top was a man's life in photographs, just as her life had been arrayed before her and Jeremy James 2 summers back, a collage yet again that said everything and said nothing. A person could be photographed every day of his life, she suspected, and still hide the truth of himself, the essence, from all who came along in pursuit of it. Her mother had stood in front of her every day for 20 years, and she knew her only as much as Elizabeth had deemed fit to show. And now here was her father, staring back out at her from 4x6s and 5x7s and 8x10s, in focus, out of focus, oversaturated and underlit. But in all cases, he was ultimately unknowable. She could see his face, but not behind it.
He had a couple of stepkids,
Milo told her.
Ellen had a son when he met her. Maddie had a daughter. Don't know that he formally adopted either of them. Never got a feeling one way or the other, whether he liked them or they liked him back, or if it went the other way. Or somewhere in between.
He shrugged, looked down at the collage.
He knew a lot about whiskey. Had a couple motorcycles over the years he was fond of. Had a dog for a while that got cancer, so he never got another.
And he worked here for 25 years?
About that.
Did he have any ambitions beyond being a bartender? Milo looked off for a bit, trying to remember.
When he was really into motorcycles, he talked with another guy for a while about opening a garage together where they'd fix them, maybe customize them. When the dog died, he read up a lot on veterinary schools, but nothing ever came of any of it.
He shrugged.
If he had any other dreams, he kept them tucked on a high shelf.
Why did he stop working here?
Didn't like taking orders from Ronnie, probably. Hard to take orders from a man you watched grow up. Got tired of the commute, maybe, too. He lived in Elkton. Traffic between here and there gets worse every year.
He looked at her in such a way that she knew he was sizing her up, making a decision.
You wear nice clothes. Look like you got a good life.
She nodded.
He didn't have no money. You know that? What little he had, the exes took.
Again, she nodded.
Grayson.
The small hands caressed her heart this time, coldly, but lighter than a whisper.
Leland David Grayson,
Milo said.
That was the man's full name.
She met his second wife, Maddie, at a small park in Elkton, Maryland, a town that felt tossed aside, its hills dotted with the shells of factories and foundries no one living could probably remember in their heyday. Maddie Grayson was teetering between overweight and corpulent, the rowdy smile she'd worn in most of the pictures replaced with one that had seemed to drain a second after it appeared.
It was Steph, my daughter, who found him. He was on his knees in front of the couch, but his right elbow was still on the couch, like he'd got up for a drink or a piss, and that's when it took him. He'd been there at least a day, maybe two. Steph had gone around to borrow some money because, well, Lee could be a soft touch on his drinking days. But outside of that, he wanted to be left alone. What he liked to do on his days off was drink decent whiskey, smoke cigarettes, and watch old TV shows. Never new ones. He liked stuff from the 70s and the 80s. Mannix and the A-Team, Miami Vice.
She turned